It's been a great conference, hasn't it? And, we're going to finish strong with our conference in our final two plenary sessions. My name's Ned Hook. I'm from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. I've learned a lot today and throughout the conference, and I know I'm going to learn a lot with our next speaker. Dr. Randolph Nesse is listed in your program as a faculty member in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. That, unfortunately, is incorrect. Dr. Nesse is evolving in terms of his positions and has recently moved from Michigan to Arizona, where he's taken a position as director of the Center for Evolutionary Medicine at the university, at Arizona State University. Dr. Nesse is a psychiatrist by training, but he's had a long-standing interest in evolution, not only of humans and human behavior, but also the pathogens that cause them and their interactions. And so this is a new topic for us at this conference. It'll be fast-moving. It'll be broad in its topic, and I know it'll be informative and no doubt thought-provoking to all of us. So I very much appreciate Dr. Nesse joining us to present his moving. It'll be broad in its topic, and I know it'll be informative and no doubt thought-provoking and treatment. Thanks very much, Dr. Nesse.
Thanks so much for that very kind introduction. I should say that I've thoroughly enjoyed this meeting. I've been a practicing physician for 40 years, and I know, as you all know, that there are all kinds of very practical things that one needs to accomplish in order to make things work well, quite separate from all the grand theory. Today, however, I am your speaker for truly grand theory. I think you'll be fascinated, not by the practical things I have to offer. They're not that practical, but you sure will find them interesting. And I've just turned everything off. Here we go. First of all, I emphasize that you do have real experts on evolution and STDs, some right here amongst you. Andy Nemias and Dan Danielson and Susan Nemias organized a conference and Nobel Symposium in Stockholm 3 years ago and published a special issue of the New York Academy of Sciences with wonderful articles. Most of what I'm going to say is already in that journal. Take a look at it if you're interested in this topic. Take-home points. First of all, evolution is a crucial basic science for medicine, except it's one that simply has been left out of the curriculum. Most doctors don't know beans about evolutionary biology. Two, sex turns out, why does sex exist at all? It turns out it's to prevent infection, even though it causes lots of infections. Three, sexual behavior evolved not for our good, but for the good of our genes, and that really exposes us to a lot of unfortunate problems. And finally, antibiotic resistance evolves fast, and if we want to do something about it, we need to understand that what we're talking about is evolution. So do you ever feel like the work you're doing is really hard, and no matter how hard you try, you can't quite completely succeed? I'm here to tell you why. Because the behaviors you're trying to change are being shaped by natural selection. There are people who aren't that interested in sex, and they do not have very many children. Then again, there are pathogens that are quite easy to kill off, and they don't go to the next generation either. And both people and pathogens are constantly co-evolving in ways that keeps us susceptible to these diseases. It's a hard fight, and you all are making enormous progress. I'm really impressed. We need to keep doing it. Natural selection in one word, well, one sentence. If variation is an inheritable trait influence the number of offspring, then that trait's going to change over the generations. There's no argument about whether this is a theory. It's a formula. It has to be true. And the best example is Darwin's pigeons. Those pigeons all came from one common ancestor, but because they were bred for different characteristics, they came out to be quite different. Darwin actually made two different discoveries, which people don't appreciate properly. One is that all life came from a common origin, but the other is an explanation for why organisms are the way they are. The first explains things like why all these different, enormously different breeds of dogs came from one ancestor, that's wolves, just in the past 20,000 years or less. But the other explanation is what we're about today, and that's adaptation. That actually is an insect, a butterfly, but it doesn't look much like a butterfly. That's because there's been a lot of variation in the wings of that insect and its forebears, and those that look more and more and more like a leaf survive better and better and pass on more of their genes. What is evolutionary medicine? It's not a special way of practicing medicine. There's nothing radical or alternative about it. It's just applying the basic science of evolutionary biology to medicine, just like applying physiology or microbiology or anatomy or biochemistry. It's growing very fast, actually. Maybe some of you aren't aware of this. These are some of the books, including the one of mine that has kind of gotten the field going now 20 years ago. But what's nice is that this one from Oxford Press is a second edition. This one, too, is in a second edition. There's our first textbook, came out just 4 years ago. And there's a lovely introductory book that came out just last year. This is growing very fast. We now have a foundation, a blog that is a central information for the field. That's called the EvMed Review, and an Oxford Press journal edited by Steve Stearns. And new programs in evolution and medicine are taking root at universities all over the world. Our society, Evolutionary Medicine Society, will have its first meeting in Phoenix in February of next year. If you're interested in this, either send me a note or look online and get information. It'll be really fun to be in on the ground floor of a whole new field. Here's the new question that's gotten us all going. Why didn't natural selection do a better job? There are all these aspects of our bodies that just are not as good as they could be. Some are perfect, or the eye, the heart valves, it's fabulous. But other parts are at least as bad as a Yugo on blocks. Just hopeless. The appendix, the narrow size of the birth canal, our inability to control our sexual impulses even when we know we're having sex with someone who might be very dangerous for our very life. What's going on here? Again, we have this incredible perfection that you see the first years of medical education. The nephron is amazing. The heart is beyond belief. The eye, the hand is really remarkable if you look into it carefully. The clotting cycle. And then there's biochemistry, which, aside from being a bunch of stuff you need to memorize, is fabulous when examined from an evolutionary viewpoint. That's the first part of medical school. Then you go to start seeing patients. And what do you see? Well, you see wisdom teeth. Who put those there? Who wants them? How about the appendix? Are you really glad you have an appendix? No, you aren't. How about your bones that are not thick enough in certain places so they break very easily? And then there's atherosclerosis, which most of us in this audience have already growing in our coronary arteries. Women, what do women really want? What women really want is something other than that narrow, painful passage for childbirth. A zipper would be much more convenient. And finally, the spine. People ask, what's wrong with my spine? Don't ask about why individuals have problems with their spine. Ask why we all have problems with our spine. And it's because we were designed to go around on all fours. And it's only been a few hundred thousand years that we've been standing upright. Well, maybe a million, but not enough to fix our spines. So this is the question. Why has natural selection left us so vulnerable? And the answer I was given in medical school is, natural selection isn't that good. It's kind of random, and mutations happen. Can't keep things perfect. That's a very naive biological explanation. A more modern explanation is that there are 6 good evolutionary reasons for any trait that leaves us vulnerable. I'm only going to talk about 2 today. The first one is that selection does not, in fact, maximize health. That's a very disturbing idea. But if you think about it for 2 seconds, you realize that those individuals who do things that maximize their reproduction will pass on more genes, even if that harms their health. And you all deal every day with people whose behavior is doing things that maximize their genetic benefits at a huge cost to their health. Second of all, pathogens evolve faster than we can. Instead of being surprised by this, we should be surprised that multicellular organisms can cope at all because they evolve so much faster than we do. For more on the other explanations, see my website. There's lots of interest there. So this leaves us with good questions about STDs. The first one is, why on earth is there sex at all? There are other ways to reproduce. Second, why is it so hard to control sexual behavior, even amongst really smart, capable people? 3, why sexually transmitted diseases? Why don't they get amongst us by some route other than sex? And 4, why can't we conquer pathogens and just get rid of them? Do you know that sex is an evolutionary mystery? Not completely solved yet? Here's why it's a mystery. It's inefficient. It's costly. It's dangerous. But the big thing is that you can have twice as many offspring each generation if you skip the sex, basically skip males, and just reproduce parthenogenetically. Here's an example. A non-sexual reproduction, though sex on the bottom, that fish has four, doubles its number every generation. The group at the top just has two fish, reproducing two more fish every generation. You can see how a mutation that would allow non-sexual reproduction would take over very quickly, because the individuals who didn't have to bother with males who don't produce offspring would just have a lot more offspring. So what's going on? How on earth can natural selection maintain sex at all? It turns out, and there's a lot of debate about this still, that sex exists because of disease. In my town of Ann Arbor, they once planted beautiful maple trees all through the city, and they were all genetically identical. Do you know what happened to those maple trees? Some insects figured out the code and wiped them all out in a single year. Those are clones, essentially. And clones essentially have locks that are all identical. Pathogens have keys, and they're constantly experimenting with their keys to figure out how to get in. If all the individuals are identical, the pathogens break in and wipe out the entire group. Lizards are a great example. On some islands in the Caribbean, every once in a while, a gene does show up that allows lizards to reproduce without sex. And those populations quickly take over the entire island for a few years. After a number of generations, they generally suddenly go extinct because something wipes them out. The ones that do have sex persist longer. On the right-hand side, there's aphids. Aphids have a better strategy yet. They reproduce asexually when they're growing very fast, when they can get lots of plant nutrients. But when they're in a bad time and it's dry, the aphids switch their strategy and go to sexual reproduction and fly away to try to find a new plant. Really remarkably good. This is called the Red Queen theory, based on Alice in Wonderland. You remember the Red Queen? She told Alice, "I'm running as fast as I can to stay in the same place." And this is the idea that we large organisms have to evolve as fast as we can in order to keep ahead of the pathogens who are evolving as fast as they can, which generally is faster. That's why we have to mix up our genes every generation, even though it cuts in one half the amount of offspring we can have. Here's another question. Why two sexes? And what's the real difference between males and females? So this is the book I recommend to you if you're interested in evolution and sex and evolution and biology. It's by Bobby Lowe, a colleague of mine. It's called Why Sex Matters, and it's just a lovely, accessible read about how you can understand sex and sexual behavior in evolutionary terms. It really should be required reading for people who treat STDs. And on the front of the cover there, you notice that there's a tiny sperm and a gigantic egg. Why is it that sperm are so tiny and eggs are so large? Well, it's because of natural selection. Big stable gametes can last a long time. Little tiny gametes are cheap and they can swim fast. Middle-sized gametes don't have a chance because they don't either last long enough or swim fast enough. So natural selection diverges the population into two subtypes, big gametes and small gametes. This leads to a crucial trade-off. There's two things you can do to have more offspring in the long run. One is to just plain have more offspring, but then a lot of them are likely to die. Especially in a species like ours, you have to actually take care of them. And that means there's a constant trade-off in all of our lives between investing in reproduction and mating and investing in caring for offspring. And we all know this from our personal lives deeply. No solving it. Then there's something else we notice about sex. People usually care quite a lot about who they have sex with. And it's not just people. Did you know that Drosophila, fruit flies, are very picky about who they have sex with, and they make the opposite one do a little dance, macarena, before they'll agree to mate? That's because there's a lot of benefit in choosing someone with good genes to be your mate so that your offspring do better. But you also notice that for most species, females are more choosy than males. Why is that? Well, for males, more matings causes more offspring, but not for females. Having more matings really doesn't get you more offspring. On the other hand, better mates is something that's more advantageous for females than males, although humans, again, are quite peculiar in the animal world here because males help to raise those offspring, and so females choose them and males choose the females in a very complicated dance. Here's a good one for you. Why bother with internal fertilization? Why not be like some fish and just spew your eggs and sperm into the sea and be done with it? And then there's no danger of sexually transmitted disease. Well, there are benefits of internal fertilization. First of all, more efficient use of sperm, more reliable delivery to the right place, and more ability to specify who your offspring will be from. Then there are costs. All that sexual equipment, it's not only kind of embarrassing sometimes, it's very expensive, and a lot of things can go wrong. And then there's the big one, risks of sexually transmitted disease. Do you think it's just humans and monkeys? It's not. Flowers have careful defenses against diseases, and birds, before they have sex, usually inspect the cloaca of the opposite bird that they're thinking of mating with to check very carefully to see if it might have a sexually transmitted disease before they go ahead, because not doing that checking might lead to a disease that makes them infertile, and that's very bad for your genes. How much sperm should you make? Well, the answer for different species is quite different. It depends. Are those sperm any small amount going to be enough? Or is it likely that multiple males will have sperm in the female at the same time, meaning that they're all competing to get an egg? This can actually be studied, and in brilliant work done quite a while ago now by Harcourt and Short, they show that there's a graph of the body weight of an individual versus testis size, and you notice that right at the top of the heap are chimpanzees, closest to our predecessors. Humans are just barely below the line. Along with orangutans and gorillas, you'd think a gorilla has big testes because it's big and male. No, no. A gorilla has testes about the size of a pea. Why? Because the female's not having sex with anybody else. On the other hand, in chimps, she's having sex with lots of others, and a male who has small testes is not going to have very many offspring. We humans, some people put humans just above the line, some just below the line. Our testes are large enough, suggesting that competition within the female happens sometimes, but not that much. The human strategy is quite special reproductively. It is that two parents are really needed to raise an offspring because they're so helpless and they need to learn so much. Therefore, we've been shaped to have pair bonds, different kinds of pair bonds than in any other primate. We're really much more like birds than other primates because trying to raise a child alone, as many of you know, is really hard. And this leads to other things like jealousy, because that becomes necessary and beneficial once there are pair bonds. Ovulation gets concealed in humans so that other males can't immediately take over a female who isn't estrus. And also we have a short interbirth interval compared with chimpanzees because women can get a lot of help from kin and others in the group. So selection maximizes reproduction, not health, I said. What's the evidence for that? Well, the best evidence is that half of you in this room have bodies that are actually vulnerable and kind of feeble and just not as well designed for long life as the other half in this room. You know who you are. It's us guys. We just are not shaped by natural selection for enduring survival. Go to a nursing home and sit down at lunch and try to find a man. You don't see very many. I've done research on this looking at the mortality ratio of males to females by age and by sex. And there's marvelous data available, some from the CDC. Any ratio greater than 1.0 means that more than 100 males are dying each year compared for each 100 females. I thought when I started this work that for every female who's dying in Atlanta at age 20, you might get, 105, 110. No, that's not right. The data showed this. This is for 20 different countries. Turns out that for every 100 females in the United States at age 20 who die, 300 men die. The risk of death is 3 times higher. What's wrong with those men? A better question is, why did natural selection shape men to, first of all, do wild and crazy things? But it's not just sex and violence that causes their early death. It's that their tissues are not as capable of repairing themselves because more investment in matings and competition benefits their genes more than more investment in doing sensible things and taking care of themselves and their tissues. So, can you think of a trait that's good for your genes but bad for health? I think you can. It's sex. Sex is great for your genes, but it's really bad for health on so many different counts. So enough about us. I've talked so far about evolution of us and our predilections. Second part here is talking about them, that is the STDs. Why on earth are they so mean to us? Why don't they just go someplace else or find some other route of transmission? These slides are courtesy of Andy Nemias, who has them in his wonderful article in that special issue in the New York Academy of Sciences. Notice that there are a variety of things generally at lower parts on the phylogenetic tree that make their living by getting transmitted between humans via sexual means. They're small. Why? Because big things can't make it that way. And I think instead of thinking of them as just nasty things, we need to think of things from the STD's point of view. They're just small organisms trying to get food, stay safe, reproduce, and especially find good housing for their kids. Again, a slide from Andy. Too much on that slide, and you've heard it all before. There are a lot of organisms that are transmitted sexually, but not that many. You know, it's really a dozen that specialize in transmission this way. So why bother specializing? Why not be spread by aerosols and by touch and by other things too? Well, mainly it's because of its safe passage. It's wildlife corridors, essentially, that allow these things to get safely from one individual to another. Essentially, we provide a private delivery service to a new home. We're like movers. And that service keeps them warm and moist and in a dark, safe place on the journey. STDs are special, though, compared with other kinds of infections. It's good for an STD to be relatively mild, because if it kills you in 2 or 3 years, especially in populations where people don't change sex partners very much, it'll never spread. Much better to be a longer-lasting infection, so that even in populations where people only change sex partners after somebody dies or something, they can still spread. Lack of symptoms is best, so that your partners won't reject you. Huge numbers are not that necessary, because just a few concentrated in the right place is plenty to get them onto their next host. And they don't need to be that infective, because people have sex quite a lot, actually, and so making sure that they get transmitted every single time is not necessary. And another thing very important and hopeful for us is that these organisms tend, in many ways, to be quite delicate. They can't survive outside the body. Anything that's too cold or too dry or too much sunlight wipes them out very, very quickly, amazingly quickly. They're specialists. Virulence. A lot of people have the idea that long association of a pathogen and host lets the pathogen to get more and more mild, because why bother killing your host? A great example of that actually happening is with syphilis coming to the old world. 1495, it was an acute and often fatal disease. And it took just a few hundred years for it to become milder and milder and less, so it's now a chronic disease where often people are asymptomatic entirely. But that's not always the case. In some cases, natural selection makes an organism more virulent. And by virulent, I mean more nasty and more likely to kill you faster. Things that are spread by mosquitoes, like malaria, can do it even better if you're lying there comatose than if you're slapping at the mosquitoes. Needles, the more they're used, if you have more particles in your blood that are infective, it'll spread better. And then there are health professionals. Especially in infant nurseries, in the intensive care unit for kids, if nurses don't take great care, then the babies who have the most diarrhea will spread their bacteria to other babies, and there will be a selection even within that nursery over a year for more and more virulent strains. You all know about resistance. You all know it's very fast. This is just a graph showing that no agent lasts very long. These things are evolving so fast that it's amazing we can ever keep ahead of them, and in fact we can't, and the possibility that we're losing the race with gonorrhea and possibly syphilis is terribly frightening and should be. That's a graph you've all seen about gonorrhea. But this is a graph that's worth looking at. This is one that shows the amount of antibiotic use per population and the amount of resistance. And it's just a nice straight line. Countries where there's more antibiotics used have more resistance. Quite simple. So in this country, we still use antibiotics in food, or in farm animals. There have been some attempts to control it, but our FDA and USDA have been not that effective, actually. Nothing like Denmark or the European countries that don't allow such things. And we're all suffering as a result. This is a result of a political failure. And I don't know what we can do about it. I hope the CDC people here will talk to us about that. Sequential drug treatment. That's what I was taught in medical school. Don't use multiple drugs at once because you might use them up. You might need another one later. That's completely wrong from an evolutionary point of view. You want to use multiple drugs all at once when necessary and when it's safe and cost-effective, because that's going to prevent the development of multiple drug resistance. Vaccines are the best solution, and we always think of the diphtheria vaccine, but it's special. The diphtheria vaccine is not actually a vaccine against diphtheria. It's a vaccine against the diphtheria toxin. And this results in selection of four organisms that don't make the toxin. So the organisms are still all around us and growing fine, but not the nasty ones. Imperfect vaccines pose a special challenge. If a vaccine can kill off every member of the group, polio vaccine and like, great. On the other hand, we're having vaccines against pathogens, viruses that have multiple variants. Marek's disease in chicken is one, and vaccination led to emergence of new clones of that virus that were more virulent than before. And it looks like we're facing a more minor version of that with the HPV vaccine. We're dealing with multiple different clones, and we're doing pretty well, and I think we can keep ahead of it. This is absolutely no reason not to use it. We should all be getting our HPV vaccine, especially for younger people. But we do need to be recognizing the evolutionary dynamics of how giving a vaccine changes the environment in a way that changes selection pressures on a vaccine, changes selection pressures on a virus, possibly to make it worse. We need to be thinking about these things in proper evolutionary terms. HIV is special. It's transplanted from other species, like many other things are, but it's nothing like, you know, the hundreds of thousands of years we have of association with gonorrhea. It's a retrovirus, but its mutation rates are just massive, just on the verge of not holding its genome together. Also, it's really not that infective, probably because it hasn't been associated with us quite that long. But the big thing is, it evolves so fast within individuals that what we're dealing with is fighting evolution whenever we treat somebody with HIV. It's tough to fight, and as one author said in an article in Cell, the number of particles and the amount of mutation means that literally every single possible genotype is already present in someone by the time they have a full-blown HIV infection. That means there's something there that's going to be resistant to almost anything we throw at it. It's been an absolute miracle that with triple drug therapy we've been able to get control of the disease for many people. We need to keep finding agents and fine-tuning